Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we have a special program for you today.
Yeah, so you're probably listening on a different day of the week.
And we just wanted to get the word out, because it's a very special place.
Yeah, sometimes we just come across a place that's so good, and we get so much wonderful information that we think you'll be interested in, that we decide to do a special program. And this is a very special program about a rather unique restaurant in Los Gatos, California, called Manresa, and a partnership between the chef, David Kinch, and a lady who runs a farm about 30 minutes away in the Santa Cruz Mountains called... It's Love Apple Farm.
Love Apple Farm. I was calling it Lady Apple Farm, but I was going to ask her if she had a lady apple tree. Apple Farm, Cynthia.
And the owner is a lovely lady called Cynthia Sandberg. So first of all, we'll hear from Chef David Kinch, then we'll take a break, and then we'll resume a conversation, a four-way conversation between Ann, Peter, Cynthia, and David all on the phone together at the same time.
We're really looking forward to an adventure again this evening for dining. We're at Manresa, and we're talking to Chef David Kinch, who has an ever-growing reputation as being very much your own person, your own chef. Welcome to On the Menu, David.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have been winning awards lately, right and left, and you've earned a lot of ink in all the glossy magazines. You're pretty much doing what you've always done on your own terms, aren't you?
I'd like to think so. I've always believed, I enjoy cooking. I enjoy very much what I do. And I'm a strong believer that awards and accolades tend to be the byproduct of working very hard and being very passionate of something you love to do. It's not the goal. It tends to be the byproduct.
Well, no, you are originally from Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania Dutch.
And Lancaster County. Huh?
That's correct.
Where you were exposed to wonderful products.
Exposed to wonderful products. I was exposed to great cooking. I was very fortunate to have two sets of grandparents. I had great cooks on both sides of the family. We did a lot of family reunions and a lot of family get-togethers when I was a very young age. In fact, my earliest culinary memories are of these family reunions on hot summer days, and many people running around, the smell of food being cooked.
It wouldn't have been pretty much country in terms of the kind of food you'd be eating.
It was pretty country. It was back, Reamstown, Adamstown, Denver, Ephrata, around in that area in Lancaster County. So it's definitely farmland. It's in the heart of the real great farmland.
But I'm just thinking, because I always think of that area of Pennsylvania as being noodles and dumplings.
Very good noodles and dumplings.
But then you moved south.
My father had a job that traveled required for him to move from place to place. I spent a lot of time moving around in the deep south. I think my love for travel and non-fear of traveling and adventure and experiencing new things probably came from moving around a lot in my formative years.
And you ultimately, or not ultimately, but for a while there, you ended up in a fabulous gastronomic capital, New Orleans.
Yes, I went to high school in New Orleans. It's still one of my favorite places in the entire world. I love to go back and visit. I still have many friends there. It's a great eating town. And
it sure is.
And it is purely the town. I give the town complete credit for engaging me in the industry that I'm working in now.
You said to me a little bit ago that you've never worked in anything else except restaurants.
No, I've only worked in restaurants my entire career. I'm very one-dimensional that way.
You've never given any thought to anything else?
I've been interested in a lot of different things. I was very interested in wine for a long period of time. I've had an interest in wine from a very early age. But I think what that did is it helped with my passion for cooking and understanding the synergy between food and wine, which I'm still fascinated with to this day.
And you've lived in Spain. You've been exposed to the Nuevo Cochino Basque.
Well, I worked in Spain. I started traveling to Spain on a regular basis back in 1985. I went to Spain for non-culinary reasons. I was working in New York City at that time, and the restaurants that I worked at in New York closed for the entire month of July. So I was getting on a plane, and I was just going to Spain and backpacking for that month, and I did that for about 5 years in a row. And that's when I first became, back then, Spain was off the beaten path.
It was
France and it was Italy, and Spain you didn't hear much about. And I became really enamored with the food that was going on. It was very traditional minded. And when I decided at one point to go and do some extended stages in Europe, I wanted to make sure that Spain was on that itinerary. And I did end up working in Spain. I ended up working there for over half a year in San Sebastian.
Oh, absolutely the heart of it all, isn't it?
Yes, but this was in 1992. So this was really before the explosion, a lot of the new wave and the hyper-modern cuisine that you see now.
Yeah, well, hyper, yeah. But there was still, I guess it's a fallout from the Nouvelle Cuisine of France, though, isn't it?
Well, I think I can only speak for what I was exposed to over there, which was in the Basque country. Mm-hmm. You had, at that time, I think the word that was on everybody's lips was a nouveau Basco.
So yeah.
A new Basque cuisine. It was Pedro Subijana at Acalari, which is where I worked.
And Arzac.
And Arzac. And Juan Marie Arzac were really kind of the godfathers of that. They had gone to France. They were heavily influenced by the Nouvelle Cuisine people. Mostly Bocuse. I think they both spent time working for Paul Bocuse, and they brought back what they learned, you know, the whole aesthetic and the mindset, the approach to ingredients and the dictates of Nouvelle Cuisine in the 70s, 80s, and they brought it to their traditional cuisine. And that's the period that I was involved in. You know, we were still slicing plates of hams and we were still cooking cocochas, which were great. It's like one of my
favorite. I think they still do that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of my favorite things to make for myself and to fool around with is still making a peel, which you don't see much of here in the U.S.
Yeah. And you worked in France. You love France. You were in Japan.
That's correct.
So you've been all, and then how did you end up in California?
I came to California. I had worked in New York for many years. I was in New York for about eight.
Where did you work there?
I was at the Quilted Giraffe for the majority of the time, for 5 years. In the early 80s, back when
everybody still raves about it. They miss it, the Quilted Giraffe.
The Quilted Giraffe was, the Quilted Giraffe certainly had a huge influence on how I do things here, not only on cooking, but just general approach to customer satisfaction, an emphasis on doing whatever it takes to make the customer happy. My great memories is there was a certain period at that restaurant in 1985, 1986, where it was a veritable who's who of American cooks working the line in that kitchen. You had a lot of great people come out of there.
Some of them right here in San Francisco.
Tom Colicchio was working there, Wayne Nish from March, Noel Comas, who was the founder of Tomcat Bakery, who I thought for years and years made the best bread in New York. He sold it to all the great restaurants in New York. I know he just recently sold the bakery. There was a lot of talent in that kitchen, and it was a real great exposure for myself.
So what lured you to California?
Well, I left New York to explore something new. I went to Japan. I had originally planned to stay in Japan for several years. That did not work out. Circumstances beyond my control, and I had to return to the United States after a period of time, and I really didn't have anywhere to go. My parents had recently moved to the Bay Area in California, so I stopped with them to kind of try and figure out what I was going to do next. I stayed here for a bit, considered going back to New Orleans. I almost went back to New Orleans to open up a restaurant there, then ultimately decided I would stay in California. I'll tell you, it was hard to get off the plane in February, and I still remember how the air felt when I got off the plane.
Yeah,
I was like, boy, this isn't New York anymore, you know. And I was just amazed at the produce and the quality.
Yeah, see, this feeds exactly into your interest in cooking, all that's available to you. So chefs in California get very spoiled, I believe.
Well, we have a responsibility with that. Can't mess it up. You know, that's the dictate. The cook is not a magician. You cannot take a mediocre product and through the magic of your culinary skills turn it into a dish that is really extraordinary. It might taste good, but you cannot change the laws of physics. It all starts with the quality of the produce. And, you know, I know we were going to talk about the garden, but, I mean, that's...
Yeah, I'm going to move on to that one.
We bought everything from farmers markets. We always go to farmers markets. We bought directly from farms. There's a couple of people that I've been buying from on a regular basis since 1995, who their business has grown along with mine. So we have long-standing relationships. But there's a period in time where I was going to the farmer's market and I got tired of seeing the same chefs buying the same produce as I. As good as it was, I was buying the same Swiss chard, the same peaches, the same strawberries, the same torpedo onions as everybody else. And that got us started to thinking, what could we do to separate ourselves, cause a degree of separation? You know, how can we step away from that and be even better? And the logical step was to start to grow it ourselves.
And how, first of all, the restaurant, I should mention it's actually named after a medieval town in Catalonia, Manresa. I was going to ask you that. The restaurant has been here for 7 years.
We'll be 7 years on Bastille Day.
Okay, and when did you start this farm?
We started the farm almost 4 years ago. It's run by a woman named Cynthia Sandberg, and I had been buying tomatoes from her for a couple years. She was a tomato specialist.
I love that.
She literally grows the best tomatoes I've ever tasted. She wins awards and that sort of thing. And, you know, I really didn't know what I was doing. You know, I started talking to my farmer friends and asking them, well, you know, I'm looking for lands. You know, I'm going to start a garden for my restaurant. You know, I need to start with land. Can you tell me where I can find some land, sort of thing, and finding a good quality piece of land? And I talked to Cynthia about this, and I said, you know, I'm looking for something. And she says, well, you know, that's really strange because, you know, I was thinking of turning my property here into a small farm and try to figure out if there was some sort of restaurant somewhere that would might want to buy the produce.
Okay, so it was not already a farm.
No,
you developed it.
Well, she grew a lot of her tomatoes there. She grew half her tomatoes there and the other half off-site. But she's on a 5-acre property, about a half-hour drive from the restaurant, the house. And I said, well, there's only one thing that I got to mention to you. I said, and she goes, well, what is it? And I said, well, I'd like to do something biodynamically. You know, I've been reading a lot about this, and I want to explore this because, and she goes, well, that's what I want to do too.
Oh, gee.
So it was I think it was fate that we kind of came together. Our agreement has been not much more than a handshake for the past 5 years, but Cynthia has become just as much part of this restaurant as myself or any of my staff. And she made a long-term commitment about this. She upped up her lawn. She took out a swimming pool. She cut down mature, large-growth, non-native trees. And she turned her whole commitment to us here at the restaurant. It's great for Cynthia. Cynthia can follow her passion. She can grow things of quality and follow the principles that she holds dear. She doesn't have to worry about schlepping to a farmer's market. She doesn't have to worry about invoicing or receipts. All she has to do is concentrate on what she does well. And in what I get for that is that everything grows there is for me to use.
Yeah. I've talked to a number of people about this, the procedures of biodynamic growing. And I'm not sure about the tenets of it or anything like that. All I know is that everybody who uses it says it works, and that's good enough for me.
Well, that's good enough for me, too. Cynthia can expound on it for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I've been expounded at upon for a lot
The garden has been a tremendous joy. It's been great to work with, but it's also, I think it's fair to say, it has been the single largest challenge that I've ever had in my culinary career.
Would you go and get your hands dirty and work on it?
I'm up there 4 times a week. I'm up there. I pick everything up.
Do you?
Yeah.
But
you know,
do you actually go out and...
Yeah, sure. I mean, our inspiration now is walking around in the garden. There's a lot of produce up there. There's, you know, this year we're going to have 110 varieties of tomatoes. We have about anywhere from 60 to 80 different kinds of vegetables. There's 40 different kinds of herbs. We have a lot of experimentation. We grow all our microgreens. We have chickens that are supplying the eggs. We have a lot of animal life up there to complete the biodynamic circle there, where there's an emphasis on diversity. The more it becomes self-sustaining, the better it is. Everything comes to the restaurant here. We compost everything back, and we ship everything back. We take everything
That's
back there.
That's the way there. It should be. And how does this end up on the plate? Here I'm looking menu.
This
your
is,
menu changes
this is
a lot.
Where the this is where the challenge has been, because there's certain things grow up there, and it's completely changed in the past 4 years. It's changed how we write the menus. It used to be, okay, it's springtime, peas, asparagus, mint, that sort of thing. You sit down and you piece things together. But, you know, mint might not be ready at the garden. There might be too many peas or fava beans, or asparagus is not quite ready yet. So all of a sudden, it wasn't us writing the menu, it was the garden writing the menu. And not only did that, we didn't want it to make it into this this pseudo-vegetarian kind of restaurant where the emphasis is on the provenance of the ingredients, but not the actual cooking. And that's what we were trying to find.
Yeah, that's a balance. That's a hard balance.
Well, it's a hard balance. And waste. We don't want to waste the garden because so much effort goes into it. So over the past 4 years, I mean, when we first started the garden, we had way too much lettuce and zucchini. But then we'd gap on...
Zucchini is the bane of my existence.
And then carrots. And then we'd have periods where we'd have carrots, and then we wouldn't have carrots for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. But we have fine-tuned it to where this just under 3 acre land that's growing for us is growing specific. We grow the exact amount of onions we need. We grow the exact amount of carrots that we need year round.
So you get that with experience, you know.
That's right. And we do it year round. We don't do it for 5 months out of the year. We're not a show garden. The garden's very beautiful, but it's not a show garden. We don't just grow herbs so we can tell people that we have a garden. I think what we do is we walk the walk. We don't just talk the talk.
Now, you have trees. I mean, like I see here green almond vinaigrettes. You've got almond trees?
No, not every. All the vegetables that we grow is from the garden. The rule is, especially during the spring and summer, that if it's a vegetable on the plate, then it has to be from the garden. But of course, we don't have mature orchards or anything like that.
Okay.
We do have a cherry tree. We do have an apricot tree. We do have a couple of apple trees, including some gravestines that produce spectacular fruit.
Oh, wow.
And you haven't gone to four-legged friends and finned
no, well, we,
things
we've,
yet either.
We've thinned out the roosters on occasion.
Now, I'm looking. This menu looks very interesting, but it doesn't look bizarre in any fashion. I mean, I wouldn't. Do you view yourself as eccentric?
No.
I don't think so. I think it's pretty straightforward here.
Yeah, I think the food is very reflective. It's a personal reflection of me. It's a reflection of what I like to cook, and what I like to eat, and my desire to make clients happy.
And what we'll have to do, listeners, is we'll have to wait until after dinner this evening to tell you what we had, because the menu hasn't written itself yet. Maybe the garden for the day hasn't even arrived just
yet. Well,
you're going
to the garden. You're going to the garden later.
But
well,
but the garden hasn't the garden's imp-
The garden,
effect
the garden
on
came
tonight's
in at 11
menu.
O'clock this morning.
It came in. Oh,
okay.
So it's just not written down yet.
Yes.
Now, if people come here, what do they expect? First of all, reservations, right? Make reservations.
Reservations.
Okay. Our website is?
www.manresarestaurant.com.
Okay. And that's M-A-N-R-E-S-A. I was spelling with two S's.
No, it's one S.
One S. Restaurant.com. And when they get a menu, what are their options? I see here 3 courses, 4 courses, tasting menu.
We have a list of a la carte dishes. Customers have a choice of doing a 3-course or 4-course menu. And we also have a tasting menu that's not listed, but it's basically a market menu where we cook what we want and what we feel is the best that we can offer the guests. I think that menu and that option is what we've become known for, and I'd say a good 50% of our customers choose that, which is really fantastic because nothing is listed, so they're actually putting themselves into our hands.
So you don't write it down at all?
It's not written down at all. It allows us, you know, we can buy a certain amount. We don't have to purchase to have items for the menu. Things mm-hmm. can come in small amounts of great quality, and if we run out at 8:30 a Saturday night, we just switch another dish. We have a rotation of dishes. Switch in. What's really fascinating is we can have 2 tables in the dining room, and they're sitting next to each other, and they're both doing the tasting menu, but they're looking at each other's table, and they're realizing they're getting different dishes to each other, and they might actually perceive that as that we're cooking actually just for them, and they would be right.
Well, we'll let you do that for us. I mean, you can sit as a separate tables if you like, but we're certainly more than happy to eat different things.
That'd be great. It'd be my pleasure to cook for you.
We ran into a couple at El Bulli who had been trying for years to get in and finally did. They came from, was it Germany?
From Berlin.
From Berlin. And so they wanted to go 2 nights in a row. And they had totally different, I mean, that's a pretty extreme and elaborate menu. They had totally different menus both nights.
So they knew much of what we had because it was much of what they had yesterday. But
their
dishes were completely different. Now, at that time, there were only 17 plates.
Mm-hmm.
Now the number is much larger.
Mm-hmm. I have my El Bulli story is, is I went, the first time I went was in 2000.
That's when we were there.
And I ate there with a friend of mine, and we ate, and we had a great experience. And we were talking with Chef Ferran in the kitchen afterwards, and I made some crack. I said, that was really great, but I bet you I couldn't come back tomorrow and I'd have completely, 30 dishes, completely different 30 dishes kind of thing. And he says, oh, really? Oh, really? And he walks over to the reservation book and he says, are you here Thursday, which was 3 days from then? And I said, oh, yeah, I'll be in Barcelona. He says, the kitchen tables open up. Why don't you come up on Thursday and see what we can do? And I said, sure. So I went up. I went up 3 days later and I sat down and he gave me 30 courses and he didn't repeat one dish.
All right.
So he made me eat my words. Yeah, that happened. The pleasure was all mine.
Yeah, that happened to our friends from Berlin. Yeah. Now, you made something of a pilgrimage to a restaurant that we featured on the Menu just about 6 months ago called Mugaritz.
Yes, of course.
And apparently you went there, and then you went somewhere else, and then you drove all the way back. That's what Greg told us. Maybe he was gilding the story.
Was it Mugaritz? No, I've been to Mugaritz a bunch of times now.
A bunch of times. There you go.
Yeah, I've known Anthony. Anthony and I worked together in 1992. I knew Anthony when he was 18 years old.
Oh, okay. Wow, he's young still. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a long time ago. When I was working at Occhilari, he was the fish cook, and we worked side by side, and that's when I first got to know him. So he left there. He went to go work at Arzak. His time was up at Occhilari, and he went to go work at Arzak over there. But we've remained friends to this day. He's a very talented individual.
We haven't covered your wine program, but you do have a wine pairing.
Correct.
Option.
Yes.
And what kind of wines do you have?
We have about 600 selections on the wine list. It is, I'd say, 50% French, 40% American, and the other 10% is miscellaneous. A little bit of Spanish, bottles of Italian wine. Jeff, our wine director here, we work very well together, not only with the pairings, but the general overall feel of what's available on the wine list. I mean, people come to California, and there's a lot of people who want to drink big style Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignons, and we do have some on the list, but it's not what... That's not what we fill up on. Our menu, it tends to be vegetables and fruits and fish and shellfish oriented. It tends to be on the lighter side. So the wine list reflects that. You see a big selection of white wines, very, very diverse. And in terms of red wines, they tend to be more in medium body. There's a lot of red burgundies on the list. We have a large selection of California Pinot Noirs that sell very well. That might be our biggest selling category. But in terms of big tannic wines that one would feel is more appropriate for a big piece of meat roasted over a wood fire, that sort of thing, we have some available, but it's not what we... And it doesn't show in our pairings either.
I see. Have you written a book?
Working on two books right now. Both.
Which are?
Well, one is actually, they're both actually not cookbooks per se, but they're about food. One is a book of photography from a very well-known photographer who's using the restaurant and the garden as his subject. Okay. And the other book is very, very interesting. It's talking about the ephemeral nature between music and food.
Oh,
and it's
are you being, a musician?
No, but I grew up with a very, I have a very good friend that I grew up with who is a very good jazz musician, and we're working on this together.
So, you were just in the jazz festival?
Yes, I was. Yeah, yes, I was.
They said that. Yeah. That's rocking. That's it.
Oh, my gosh.
New York just lost it, so I just read that in the Times today or yesterday. Do you do radio, television? Well, you're doing radio now, but what about... What do you do about this celebrity chef stuff?
Well, we are not real aggressive with public relations. I've always been, I have... people in-house here, member of our family here at the restaurant, who takes care of, writing press releases, getting our name out there, that sort of thing. But we have never, in the history of this restaurant, we have never hired a public relations company. My view of them is that they can be very, very expensive, and it's a cost that I have to pass on to my customer. And I might be naive in this, but I always felt that if I'm passionate about what I do, and I cook good food, then people will come. And it's one thing being a chef, but it's another thing being a restaurant owner. I'm responsible for almost 40 employees here at this restaurant and their livelihood. So it's gone from being about me and me being a chef and the food I cook and how good it is. It's gone from that to being making customers happy, paying my bills, and taking care of my employees and leading by example. You know, it's taking care of the customer has become the single most important mantra of what we do. It's become less about me and less about the celebrity of the restaurant and more about the customers. And take, you know what? You take care of customers, they come back. They come back even in recessionary times. And what's happening now is now that I'm becoming an older man, I have employees leaving now. I have great employees that have been with me for several years. They leave, and they're opening up really good restaurants on their own right now. And I'm finding out that is the single most satisfying thing in my entire career.
Lots of times we talk to chefs that add restaurants because they say they have to make room for their employees.
No. I mean, you know, you're not going to find me making a movie about myself. You're not going to find a picture book of me, you know, where all the cookbook, where all the photographs are of me. That's not going to happen. You know, at some point,
I think... you're not going to do a day in the life of. That's the latest thing. Every single chef seems to do a day in the life of.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I hope Manresa becomes an institution. I would like Manresa to continue on long after I choose not to do it, or I'm long gone. It's hard, but it's also a goal. It's also a goal. It's something we want to try and do.
Okay, well, I'm getting the signal here. You and I could chat on forever and ever, but we need to move on. We need to go tour the farm. But I'd love talking to you, and maybe we could do it again even later on.
Maybe we can do it after you have dinner tonight.
Great. You're wonderful. Thank
you. It's a pleasure to meet you. This has been really great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, David. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again. You're listening to On the Menu, and you're going to email us, I'm sure, On the Menu at onthemenuradio.com, or also join our blogs on onthemenuradio.blogspot.com, and continue along with us as you'll hear mouthwatering descriptions of what we actually ate and the farm that produced the product.
We have this wonderful, momentous discussion going on with David Kinch and Cynthia Sandberg. David is the chef owner of Manresa, which I've fallen in love with. And Cynthia, I want to come and live in your garden, which is called Love Apple.
Love Apple Farm.
Farms, okay. I was having that wrong. I kept saying, where are the lady apples? Because I didn't see any trees. But anyhow, so we got that straightened out. David, I promised in the previous interview that I would have you go through so that everybody listening will drool and understand exactly what your restaurant is about and what your chefing is about. If you would go through and describe what you served us as a tasting menu at Manresa.
Oh, gosh.
You probably can't remember it.
It changes so much. I can't even really recall what you had.
Okay, well, why don't you just go through what you would ordinarily do at any given day, depending on what you had for a tasting menu?
Well,
your specialties.
Well, you know, everything pretty much revolves around the produce that is produced at Love Apple. That certainly is the centerpiece, the fulcrum for what we do. And certainly at this time of the year, even though Cynthia is very good at producing the majority of everything we need year-round, it's spring and summer can only be adequately described as an explosion of color and perfume and variety and diversity that comes out. And our job, actually our challenge, is to harness this. And to make sure that the customer, what Cynthia does and what we do with it in the kitchen, is to pass that feeling on to the customer. I think what our special relationship is to try and put that feeling into the customer so the customer can and taste the difference. I remember realizing that all the work that we had put into it was for a good reason when the relationship first started and we started getting our first harvest when regular customers commented, something is different.
What is going on?
Something is different with the product that you're putting on the plate, and I can't quite put my finger on it. What is it?
So you actually were doing your food before you entered into a partnership with Cynthia.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, the restaurant's been open for 7 years. Our partnership is close to 4 years old now. I mean, I think we're close to, Cynthia, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we're approaching 4 years here.
Jeff.
And so, you know, our tasting menu, we have a very basic format, a series of amuses that change with the season. We have a master list of these that each table gets a couple of them, three or four, on the tasting menu, and it's usually a group of about eight or nine any given night. And we try to mix it up. We try to mix it up on purpose from table to table. So when people look over at the table next to them, they realize that people are getting different food than they got, and perhaps it leaves the impression that we're actually cooking for them, which in fact we are.
But I mean, it's just like amazing how balanced all your flavors are. I think that's extraordinary.
We tend to start off with, and then we tend to go into a period of three or four dishes that tend to highlight the garden. One might be hot, the other might be cold, one might have some raw elements, much more raw elements to it. It actually might be a soup or a savory ice cream, something along those lines. In this period, the menu ends with a dish that we call Into the Garden, which is really the statement that we want to make about the relationship between Cynthia and myself.
Well, let's hear from Cynthia. Cynthia, what's in the garden right now? What do you think that's really special?
Well, Peter, right now we harvested this morning for Chef Kinch some interesting chrysanthemum greens, some Bordeaux spinach, some Fecoidea glaciale, which is an edible ice plant.
Oh, that's the thing I wanted to get a hold of. I'm crazy about that.
You're crazy about that, Anne. Well, we'll have to set you up with some seeds.
Yeah, I mean, we encountered that in England, and I didn't understand what it was until I saw it growing in your garden.
Was that the one that you got from Chef Alan Passad?
Yes.
No, that's the one that Chef that you saw on one of your trips to France, and you sent me a link to the seed, and we had to order the seed from France, but.
That's right.
The Passard seeds are of the lychee tomato, the Morel de Balbi.
Yes, that's right. I remember that.
You know, Cynthia, I mean, I wish you were here to... I planted something that I thought was going to be the shiso. And instead it's this lacy-looking thing. I have no idea what it is.
Something grew, but we don't think it's what we think it is. But you're such a pro.
Sometimes you get bad seed. That's where that phrase comes from.
And sometimes we're
intending on growing something, and it turns out to be something completely different because of the seed source. And Chef is great at trying to make that work, whatever it turns out to be, and he's brilliant at it.
Now, are the zucchini blossoms still coming?
They're just starting.
They're just starting big time. Bursting, yeah.
Now, there are two questions I want to ask. One is, I would like to ask how this relationship got set up and how it works, okay?
Cynthia, do you want to go?
Well, 1 year, I have a friend who mentioned that I should go to and dine at this restaurant called Manresa, and I hadn't heard of them because I'm not much of a foodie.
You're not a foodie?
Well, not back then, I wasn't. I don't technically think I am now. I just appreciate really good food when I'm given it. But they directed me Manresa's way and had the most amazing meal of my life. My friend had, I think she had told the chef that a local tomato grower was going to be dining there that evening.
And he
came out, introduced himself, and asked if I would bring him some tomatoes when they came ripe later that year, which is what I did, and that's how it started.
Oh, it's amazing. And how do you work it now? I mean, how does it work, really? Does he tell you what he needs, or do you find new things?
Both. You're
so compatible, both of you, by the way.
Yeah, I think, well, we try to make an effort to maybe twice a year sit down with, at the farm and open up seed catalogs. And we'll go through it. Periods of time where she's getting ready for major shifts, either in planting, certainly between winter and summer. I know we've done it every winter, in which we go through seed catalogs and we discuss, is there anything you want? She actually hands me a bunch, and she says, go through these and see if there's anything that you want. And I sit there, and I'll mark them, or we'll talk about them, and then we'll sit down, and she'll talk to me about feasibility and amounts and perhaps some glitches or bumps in the road that might happen with it, which I'm perfectly fine with. And Cynthia is very, you know, she's a perfectionist, and sometimes she worries about things not being perfect or being a little bit less than perfect. And I have no problems with that. I know how much work goes into it. I know it's, you know, it's an act of nature. You know, it's a really a gift what we get, and we have to utilize, you know, how nature gives it to us. And that's part of the fun. That's part of the challenge also. But we have had very few failures. I can't even think of anything that we were really completely unhappy with. There was a couple things that didn't work out as well as we hoped the initial year, but what's been amazing is she's kept at it, and she's had successful crops with these things later on. So she's figured out exactly, you know, in our little particular microclimate, what certain needs needed to take place to make it work. And
I was kind of concerned. I didn't understand. Cynthia, am I wrong? Weren't you a lawyer?
I was, yes.
Now, where did you learn about all this? I mean, when we toured the farm, you knew so much in detail about each of these growing things.
Well, I went to horticulture school at night while I was practicing law because I really loved plants.
Oh, gosh.
And then quit working as an attorney after my son was born so I could be a stay-at-home mom. And then I just can't be sitting around. That's not my nature. So I just started growing stuff. And my little hobby turned into a business that now supports my family and the community, too, because I also, when we have excess tomatoes in the summer and fall, sell those to the community. That's really how I got started, selling tomatoes to my neighbors, but then it just expanded and grown from there.
Now, you have chickens, too, right? You have chickens and eggs.
We have laying hens for the, for the restaurant.
And on
the occasion when the rooster reveals himself, then that goes to the restaurant too.
and these are interesting. These are not the green eggs you think of with Dr. Seuss, but they actually do have green shells.
Some of our eggs, I can't be satisfied with just one color egg. I just can't be satisfied with one type of tomato. That's how this has got this whole thing turned out so diverse. We've got probably 20 different breeds of chicken, and they all seem to lay a different color egg from pink to blue to green to tan to brown.
Absolutely.
Yes, all different colors.
What do you think is probably the most surprising thing you've grown?
Well, there's been a lot of exotica there. Obviously, the ficoid glacial, and the brebis, the lychee tomato, which was positively lethal. It was a tomato that had these almost citrus tree-like spikes on it.
We saw that with all the thorns.
Did you see that on this trip?
Yes, it wasn't. Didn't we see that, Cynthia?
Yes, you did. It was very small, but as you noted, it's already developing its spikes even as a young plant.
It really protects itself.
Yeah, lethal is the right description for it.
There's been a lot of exotica, but I think what's most impressive is it's not one type of carrot. There's many types of carrots, each with a different flavor profile, and each giving its own level of complexity to certain dishes. There is a carrot that we grow that's called a white satin carrot, which really is just perfect in its carrotness, in its flavor. It's really hard to describe. But it's also a very light, pale yellow, almost pastel yellow-white color to it. And the greens, even the carrot top, it tastes amazingly good and very, very different.
The fact that we have a white carrot is indicative of how the garden is different from a regular farmer's market or a produce supplier that most restaurants go to, because they know that they still have to entice the customer into buying what they have to offer on the display, farmer's market, and then the normal person will walk right by a white carrot thinking it doesn't have any flavor, or a green when ripe tomato thinking that it can't be fabulous like a red tomato can, but both chefs and I know that some of these different colors, maybe the public aren't aware of, are actually some of the tastiest produce and cultivars out there. And we concentrate not only the regular-looking stuff, but the exotics as well. And it's really all about flavor rather than color. For Chef Kinch, it's all about the flavor. And that, if that's in a white carrot or a green tomato, that's what we try to grow.
You know, this gives the whole new meaning. When our son was young, we had some kind of story on tape that we put in the car that had to do with some vampire attacking vegetables, and involved, he sucked out the yellow out of carrots.
so they look like white carrots.
They were white carrots.
So people must have heard that story when they were small, and that's why they don't like white carrots.
But you two must have just the most marvelous time together.
I don't complain.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
here's a question, because we had the opportunity when we were visiting you, David, we took a visit to the farm. We thought it was a very important part of the experience, which is why we knew that we had to welcome Cynthia to the program. But Cynthia, do you really, you can't welcome hordes of visitors, can you?
No, we just don't have the time to make the farm work as intricately and as special as I like to run it, and answer questions all day from the people that would like to come and take a walk around and quiz us all day long, which happens sometimes, and we just have to close the gate and say, okay, the heck with that. We got to get really back to work.
Well, we had the chance to do that, and
but you do tours, right?
I will do tours on occasion.
Only on occasion.
For
okay.
Special groups that if everything else is taken care of.
Yeah, so what I wanted listeners to know is that they better listen to this carefully, because they're not going to have a chance to find out very much more.
I would still like David, if he could, to please pick a dish or two and just describe it so that listeners get a real feel for the style of cooking you do. One of the ones we had, or one of the ones you're doing tonight, or anyone.
Well, there's going to be a dish. It's really one of my, I think, a dish very representative of the restaurant. And it's very, very, on the surface, it's very, very simple. But last year we had a great bumper crop of a pumpkin called a potimarron. Sometimes it's called a curry squash, K-U-R-I, or potimarron in France. And it's a bright orange flesh. The seeds are really, really nice. But it really is an extraordinary tasting pumpkin. It's very, very well balanced. And what we do is we make a soup. We make a soup with salted brown butter. And it's a puree, and it's a velouté. And not only does the pumpkin taste good, but it's got a great aroma, too. And it's really perfect. So we make a soup here, and we serve the soup hot. But what we do is we make we pour the soup hot into a bowl in which we have made a savory ice cream out of nasturtium flowers. And, you know, there's similarities in color, but it's a little bit different. But the nasturtiums, you know, the really intensely aromatic floral aroma of the nasturtiums, the color, which really signifies the heart, the height of fertility in the summertime, the spiciness, it goes perfect with the soup. And I think what really makes it special, too, is that the soup is actually naturally sweeter than the ice cream, because we don't make the ice cream with much sugar in it at all.
Oh, wow.
So it's a savory ice cream. But the really amazing thing is hot, cold. You're getting a bite of something really, really cold and really, really hot at the same time. And I'm waiting impatiently for these two things to come around again, because to me it's a dish that really personifies not only the restaurants and the season, but the relationship with the farm also.
Well, I can just say to listeners, this is like a must do in California. I mean, I just, how long did we drive to get there? I mean,
it's less than an hour's drive from San Francisco International Airport.
I would
Airport.
Do it in a blink.
Unless the 101 is all blocked up.
Yeah.
So it's easily within reach. Los Gatos is a charming little village anyway. But Manresa is the place to go. We're so glad that we went. It lived up to everything that people had told us. I told Greg Silva, who made all the arrangements for us, I said, I'm expecting the Manresa is going to end our visit to California on a crescendo, and it did. And Cynthia, we particularly want to single you out and thank you for the part that you had in making that happen.
I want Cynthia to come live on your farm.
Okay,
Anne. And I sample all the things. I went to the farm eating samples of things.
She might put you to work.
I was going to say, we'll put you to work.
Well, I'm sure.
For more than 5 minutes before I have you weeding or hoeing.
Yeah, we came back to find plenty of that. But I have to tell you, I mean, we hadn't mentioned the fact that your tomato plants grow to over 7 feet tall. This is more than a green thumb.
The relationship started because we were so impressed with the tomatoes. I learned a lesson from her. Here I have been cooking for a long time, and I learned just this real primal lesson about tomatoes the first week that I met her, and it's a good lesson for everybody, and it's heirloom tomatoes. You know, everybody sees them at the farmers markets in the height of the summertime, but I don't think what people realize is that most of the heirloom tomatoes you see at farmers markets, they're always slightly underripe. A ripe heirloom tomato that's grown on the vine until it's ripe and it's perfect flavor and perfect balance and perfect aroma is too delicate to put into a truck and drive to a farmer's market. It's going to bruise and break.
Oh, wow.
There's a reason why they're not commercially viable. It's because they do not travel. So a lot of people who grow heirloom tomatoes, they grow them and they pick them slightly underripe so they can travel to the farmer's markets. And people buy them because of the pretty colors and the good flavor. But the true value of these tomatoes is to take it that extra level of ripeness on the vine. And then it all makes sense on how perfect these tomatoes can actually be. But they do not travel. They travel the 20 minutes from the garden to my restaurant without being refrigerated and served that evening. And that was a very, very important lesson to me in produce. And Cynthia grows the greatest tomatoes I've ever tasted in my life, truly. In all my travels, I never tasted anything as good as the ones that grow ripe on the vine there.
Oh, I love them. And, I mean, I love your restaurant. And you were just delightful, both of you. As I said, I mean, if I'm homeless, can I come live there? I mean, I'm not about to be homeless, but I just think if I had to choose a place, I would come there.
Once again, Cynthia.
Anne and Peter, you'll have to come back when the tomatoes are 10 feet tall.
Oh, I know.
And are perfectly ripe. And
are we now up to 10 feet, Cynthia?
Tomato tasting for you.
Yeah,
it's
and we
now
have
up to 10
dinner.
Feet.
We do a whole weekend of a tomato dinner in September, too, at the height of the season.
Well,
it's probably our best-selling event year-round for the restaurant.
Please tell Greg to send us information about that. We'll post it on our website. Tell Greg to send us information about
Greg
that.
Greg has all that information.
and now I'm going to have to serve unripe supermarket tomatoes with our dinner.
We don't have our tomatoes yet.
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to stand it, but the greens were picked 45 minutes ago.
There you go.
So that's not too bad. So we have our own little version of Love Apple Farms right here on South Island Avenue. And we just wish we had more. David, once again, thank you so much for joining us on the menu. And Cynthia, thank you so much for
pleasure
being
to meet
there.
You both.
Yeah, love
bye
you
bye.
Both. Thank you, bye.
So we sure hope you enjoyed listening to that as much as we did recording it and visiting the farm with...
I'd like to be back there roaming around the garden or the farm picking up bits of everything.
There we go. It would be fun if it was just around the corner, wouldn't it? But then I guess it wouldn't be in California.
That's true.
So anyway, that's all until the next program. So
bye-bye.